Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Side Thursday is what it was dubbed by our good buddy Horst a few months back. Thorn in the Side Thursday. Here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia, it is a frigid Thorn in the Side Thursday. I gotta figure out where the gain on my microphone keeps going. I know where it is. Wait a minute. Hold on. One of these days I gotta have a long talk with that boy. Nope. Can't blame that one on Ferg. Okay, well, whatever. It is Thorn in the Side Thursday, but all kidding aside. By the way, I mentioned Horst. His YouTube channel is Horzac, H-O-R-Z-A-C, Horzac. And you need to subscribe to his YouTube channel because Horst does a magnificent job of pulling clips from the program periodically. And he posts the audio there at YouTube, convenient for passing around and telling, so you can tell folks, give people an example of a sample, if you will, of why it is that you like to spend your time listening to the horn. All right. So by all means, do please subscribe to Horzac's channel at YouTube. A couple of other notes before we jump into the meat of the program. I am happy to say that we are now only 74. We are 74 members of the Thrifty 250 away from meeting March's fundraising goal. Just 74 people, $740, and we are done for the month. And you know what? I gotta say that if we can make that, that's pretty inspiring because we've got 7 days left. We've got 7 days left in March, and we are within striking distance of finishing March's fundraising, leaving me several days to not even have to say a blessed word about it. And that would be, well, I don't like doing this, if you can't tell. But it would be a real break for us both if that could happen. We need 74 people to kick in $10 apiece, thereby reducing the cost of the program to less than 5 cents per hour of programming when you figure in all the labor that goes into it. And really, that's a runaway steal any way you slice it. So there's that. Now, there is plenty to go into this evening, but I wanted to clear out the mailbag a little bit, if I may. Because I jumped up and out and got going so hell-bent for leather the last couple of nights that I didn't. By the way, this is day 6 of your war on the people of Libya. And let me explain why I say that. The administration, government hacks and flacks, and the for-profit media can say, it's a no-fly zone over Libya, and it's Colonel Gaddafi. I haven't seen any indication whatsoever that Muammar Gaddafi has gotten so much as a scratch. But we do know that there are a lot of people in Libya being hurt. and some of them are being hurt and or killed, perhaps, by the munitions you're paying to drop. So, you know, don't kid yourself. This is your war against the people of Libya. How do you feel about that? Do you like having a war against the people of Libya? Because it makes me feel sort of sick and nauseated inside. Day six, your war. Kind of got to own it, don't you? Those are your tax dollars going into those cruise missiles that are going into God knows where in Libya. It just is. Day six, your war against the people of Libya. Now, like I said, I want to clear out some of the mailbag. I got this from our good buddy Scott in Sweden, and it's on point and on topic. Scott wrote, Jesus, Bob, your rants on Libya make me wonder how you and I have such different information. No. The Libyan protesters did not go straight to weapons early. The first 2 weeks, there were huge rallies, very peaceful. I was riveted to Al Jazeera from day one. The peaceful protests were working until Gaddafi called out his yellow-hatted thugs, who then walked down the streets where the rallies had been held, rounding up and beating and assassinating likely protesters, flying in foreign mercenaries who attacked the peaceful demonstrations, who emptying hospitals of wounded demonstrators and disappearing the patients. Bob, Gaddafi is on a revengeful murder spree. He is shelling the cities where the demonstrations were. Shelling, shelling, shelling. Yes, much of what you say about the illegality of Obama and the EU jumping in is true. But I'm not one of Sandra's cruise missile liberals. I find the situation truly horrible, and being a bedfellow with these right-wing bastards makes me feel unclean that I can't jump into a giant condom and close off the world. I cannot let my disgust of the right-wing American warmongers salivating over Libyan oil blind me to what Gaddafi and his idiot son W. Gaddafi are attempting. I do believe that you, if faced with armed street thugs that had begun assassinating the peaceful demonstrators, might grab a weapon in self-defense. Given what Gaddafi had said he was about to do to those cockroaches, all concepts of peaceful demonstration had been cordited out of the picture. Such peaceful protests really only work if the government isn't homicidal. Tunisia's and Egypt's and possibly Yemen's may be brutal, but they didn't order the army into full onslaught. Gaddafi did. He had turned the full might of his army onto the rebels. And while you're right that there is an analogy here to Blair Mountain, the onslaught was in full flow. In short, the choice had been made on very little time. Do we bomb an army gone berserk against a rebellious civil population, or let it have its way? Your arguments are about a situation that has already been left behind. We have to say what about actual current situations, as ugly as it is. Wishing that the protesters had acted differently 2 weeks ago has become moot. I do know that most of the soldiers in that army are conscripts scared stiff of disobeying, further evidence of that regime's brutality. I don't even want to think about calculations of how many conscripts versus rebels, all from the same population pool, are going to be killed as a result of this action versus abstaining from this action. It is ugly, brutal, and no doubt illegal, but how legal is a dictatorship like Gaddafi's? We are in the realm of speculation here. What if, what if, what if? I don't know if the following means anything or not, but when Gaddafi began resurging, the regimes in Yemen and Bahrain went brutal too. They seem to think that if the West would allow Gaddafi to brutally suppress his rebellion, brutality has tacit approval. So I don't think it is as cut and dried as you present it. Yes, the power-broking vultures are circling to pounce on this corpse, but the Libyan protesters represent the oppressed poor, the long-suffering majority, who had been exploited by a cruel power elite that, thanks to George W. Bush, had been made housebroken again and open for business. Gaddafi's son, with his plagiarized PhD from the London School of Economics, purchased with a $2 million donation to the school, had become a fixture at Davos. The future for the Libyan population was becoming ever more bleak, and they had had enough. True, they were not as well prepared as the Egyptians, and their uprising was more spontaneous. but my heart goes out to them and what Gaddafi would have done to them, and still would do to them if he prevails, is their slaughter. Should our disgust of the power-broking vultures blind us? Were not these very same elites already in bed with Gaddafi Sr. and Jr.? The vultures are going to eat carrion. It is their nature. But the Libyan people, the poor who have had enough, want a different future. Even if their rebellion was too spontaneous, and they miscalculated Gaddafi's resilience, I've heard too many interviews with Libyans who all say we have no choice now. Gaddafi hunted us down for this, and now it's fight or flight. Are we really going to say sorry, but we have to be ideologically pure about this and oppose all interventions? As I wrote in the subject line, this is a lose-lose, but if I'm going to lose, I want to be on the side of the rebels. Thanks for listening. I'm still your buddy, Scott. And that's the thing. We can disagree around here without being disagreeable. And we can disagree, and the disagreement is the essence of problem solving. And I am still not convinced that waging war on the people of Libya is the answer. Because there are very few instances in the history of humankind in which war has been the answer to any question save that of, hey, why don't we have a war? You see what I mean? It is in the past that they did not choose the path of nonviolence. But I believe it is still also fair to ask how and where they got resort to weapons in such quick order. But since the question has been asked, Scott said, I do believe that you, if faced with armed street thugs that had begun assassinating the peaceful demonstrators, might grab a weapon in self-defense. That really is where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? If someone comes barreling through my door in the middle of the night, yes, I will engage in self-defense. But no, in this circumstance, I will not. I would not. The forces, you see, I don't think they're the same forces in Libya. The forces that were being nonviolent are not the same forces that had ready access to caches of firearms. It certainly doesn't look that way to me. But I want to make something abundantly clear. When I say that I am committed to principles of nonviolence, I mean I am committed to principles of nonviolence. I wrote a note back to Scott, and I noted the fact that while I am not completely conversant down to the point of quoting each and everything that either Gandhi or Dr. King ever wrote, I am unaware of any passage that says nonviolence is all well and good up to a point, but once they've drawn blood to the point that you feel like you can't stand it anymore, it's okay to go and get your guns and shoot them if you got them. Nonviolence is the most difficult discipline on earth to learn. And I do not claim to be some sort of Shaolin master of it. But I am a practitioner. And where that comes from, I can't fully explain, except the book that I was told was holy when I was a little boy has a verse in it about where, you know, Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian carpenter, who was trying to get his fellow countrymen to stop making so much trouble for themselves and innocent people. Because, you know, when the Romans crack down on you, they don't just crack down on the bad guys. They crack down on everybody. Kind of like Gaddafi. Kind of like any authoritarian state trying to maintain its own existence. Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian carpenter, or day laborer, actually. The word in Greek is technon, and that's more like the guys who hang out at Home Depot in the mornings. Day laborers. Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, said, "Whoever loves his life shall lose it." And that is analyzable on a number of levels, from the literal to the figurative, to the 20th century postmodern existential. But the meaning appears to be fairly plain. And so it is that once having committed to nonviolence, one cannot uncommit. Because if you uncommit from principles of nonviolence, that just means that you never were committed to it in the first place. And it means that you commit yourself to almost certain defeat. In the long run, if you look at it very hard, it may be impossible for people to ever fully engage in self-rule for anything more than brief periods of time. India gained its freedom from Great Britain by virtue of nonviolence, but look where that place is now. They are as eagerly pursuing the destruction of the planet as anyone else. The Ruia brothers, Shashi and Ravi, in their corporate boardroom in Mumbai, have decided that my family and I, and my neighbors, and my friends, my community, my county, my state, and my region, that we don't matter enough in the grand scheme of things, which they measure in terms of gold obtained. We don't matter enough to be allowed to live in peace. Other entities in the state of India have made similar decisions about people living inside that country. One of the stories I have in the stack for today has to do with 100,000 Bangladeshis who are not to be allowed to continue to live in peace in places where they have heretofore lived for generation upon generation upon generation upon generation. And let me make something clear. No matter how angry I become at Shashi and Ravi Ruia, or at their seven-armed god, or at the people who call themselves Christians here in America who work in service to Messrs. Ruia and their seven-armed monster god, I will not take up arms against them. Part of that is philosophical. I am nonviolent. The other part is practical. I would be gunned down in the street like a cur dog. If the company thugs didn't do it, then the local constabulary would. And they would use phrases like domestic terrorist. Should I survive, I would not even necessarily have the right to remain silent, or at least be advised of that right, and I would not necessarily be advised of my right to counsel. I just happen to know that I have them, lucky me. Don't know if you caught this or not, but it's one worth paying attention to, he said, hanging a preposition at the sentence the end of. Don't know if you caught this. After being criticized for providing Miranda warnings in terrorism cases, the FBI has reminded its agents that in some instances they can question terrorist suspects without immediately reading them their rights. The Obama Administration Justice Department said Thursday the FBI guidance issued late last year, calendar hint, that's not during the George W. Bush administration, was a reminder that investigators can delay telling suspects of their rights to an attorney and to remain silent when there is immediate concern for the safety of the public. My, what a lovely, fluid idea that is, immediate concern for the safety of the public. The guidance outlines how to use the public safety exception when appropriate. The guidelines do not change Miranda or the public safety exception, which the Justice Department does not have the authority to alter because they flow from court decisions based on the Constitution. In a statement issued by the Justice Department, it said, the evolving nature of the terrorist threat demands that we keep the men and women on the front lines advised of all lawful and appropriate tools available to them to identify, locate, detain, and interrogate terrorism suspects. The FBI guidance was issued months after Obama administration Attorney General Eric Holder offered to work with Congress on a law that would let law enforcement delay constitutional Miranda warnings to terror suspects. What have we been talking about all week? All week long we have been talking about the conduct of empire. This is part and parcel of the conduct of empire. We've also discussed the fact that empire, by its very nature, is fascistic. And this sort of rule-bending is exactly that, fascistic. One either has a right to be warned, or one does not. Because, as the saying goes, justice delayed is justice denied. So you see where I'm going, I hope. By the way, who is referenced in this story about delaying the information or the conveyance or the Miranda warning about the right to remain silent and the right to counsel? Well, the terrorism cases of Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab and Faisal Shahzad touched off a political debate last year between the Obama administration and Republicans on Capitol Hill over giving Miranda warnings to terror suspects. Abdulmutallab, a Nigerian, was charged with trying to explode a bomb concealed in his underwear as his plane approached Detroit on Christmas Day. Right. He was questioned for an hour before being given a Miranda warning. Shahzad is the U.S. citizen of Pakistani origin, charged in last year's Times Square bombing plot. He was questioned for about 4 hours before he was read his rights. Okay? So naturally, the story has in it references to two men with scary Arabic names. Interestingly, there is not a single reference in this story having to do with pasty-faced, doughy, white domestic terrorists of which attacks by whom. Ouch! Language! There have been about twice as many as there have been by anybody with scary Arabic names or disturbingly brown skin. This is the camel's nose under the tent. And that metaphor exists because anyone who's ever been around a camel knows that when you get the camel's nose under the tent, it ain't long before the hump's there too. And then you've got a camel in the tent. In this instance, meaning that once you start eroding rights, pretty soon there are no rights left to erode, citizen. Now, the only hope one has in all of this nasty, creeping fascism is nonviolence. And I will be nonviolent. Exceptions being someone coming through my door, in which case I will engage in the defense, not of myself, but of those that I love, who otherwise are incapable of defending themselves. So no, if I was faced with armed street thugs that had begun assassinating peaceful demonstrators, I would not grab a weapon in self-defense, Scott. I would not do it. Because that is the confession that your side lacks the moral high ground that it has otherwise occupied. I do not believe, based upon what I have read, I do not believe that there was, I do believe that there is something afoot in Libya that was not present in Tunisia and was not present in Egypt. There is more here than meets the eye, and that is why they transitioned to firearms and gave up all pretense of nonviolence. As they did. Because one of the central tenets of nonviolence is that if you kill everybody, what's left to rule? Not much. And yes, there are brutal crackdowns taking place in Bahrain. Our dear friends, the Saudis, are providing substantial assistance in that regard. Yemen is just nasty with what's going on there. It's beginning to boil in Syria. While we were in Washington, D.C. this past weekend, right near us, in fact, interspersed and intermingled with us, were a group of Syrians protesting President Assad's brutality. They had their Syrian flags and were chanting in Arabic, and I tell you what, those Arabic chants would just raise the little hairs on the back of your neck. Maybe it would have been little hair raising if it had been in Inuit or Spanish, for that matter. But it was something I had never heard before up close. And it was knowing what they were protesting. It was inspiring. So I don't feel like I'm speculating at all. I know that nonviolence works, but I also know that nonviolence is violent. It is just that those practicing nonviolence are not perpetrating any of it. To take up arms is to confess cowardice. To take up arms is to confess that one does not really have the dedication to freedom that one has claimed. And frankly, ultimately, I have no confidence that this is going to end well for anyone. First and foremost, there will be the horror on the ground. Is the United States using depleted uranium munitions? That has yet to be determined. It does seem rather foolhardy to use a $1.1 million missile to take out a Seoul tank, though, doesn't it? I mean, a country could break itself on the rocks of conflict pretty quickly, trying to take out one tank at a time with $1.1 million missile. Oh, we're told that, oh, well, you know, we're going to be ramping this down and turning this over to somebody soon. The only problem is we don't know who somebody is. It's my understanding Turkey vetoed any idea of turning the to NATO. Yeah, no, mm-mm. France didn't want NATO to have it either. So we don't know exactly who's going to get to have all the joy of running this carnage. But even though we ostensibly turn it over to some other entity, assuming that we do, we're still going to be the primary participant. And at the end of all of this, what will the most that anyone can hope for, really, is a partitioned state. You know, the whole North Vietnam, South Vietnam, North Korea, South Korea. Yeah. Because Gaddafi, I don't think Gaddafi's going anywhere. Because he knows that we really can't make him. Because we're unwilling to put boots on the ground. The man reads and listens and watches the news. He knows that we have an exhausted military that is not ready for another foray into some godforsaken desert, where their blood can seep slowly into the sand, and their pieces can be picked up and put in bags and sent home gelatinized to their grieving parents. I will say this much, however, and this may sound very, very mean of me, but if it is war that we want, if it is war that this country desires, and oddly enough, it looks like this country does not desire war in this case. Well, no, I take that back. CBS News poll suggested that 70% of Americans think Barack Obama done the right thing setting them cruise missiles loose on them brown people. That'll show them. But if it is war this country wants, then by God, let's have it. Let's quit this pussyfooting around the edges of warfare and send in the boots and conquer Libya and occupy Libya just like we occupied Iraq, just like we occupied Afghanistan, and let that slow, miserable stream of sorry death start coming home to Dover Air Force Base in C-130s. If that is what America wants. Because eventually, you can't get the goal that you desire until you do that. You can't, a cruise missile cannot occupy a country. A cruise missile, is hard-pressed to take out a brutal dictator who kills his own people. Now, granted, Ronald Reagan did manage to slaughter a three-year-old baby in her cradle who was related to the daughter of Muammar Gaddafi. But it didn't get rid of Gaddafi, did it? Mm-mm. No, it didn't. I repent of suggesting that what America needs is a good, nasty, bloody occupational war. I would not wish that on a Republican. Because even Republicans, I think, love their children. and it is those children who would die putting boots on the ground. But I, for one, am unwilling to suggest that it is worth some mother's son's life, some wife's husband's existence, for us to rain death and misery from the sky. I don't have much. Don't have much at all. I drive a 16-year-old pickup truck with a rusted roof and bald tires. I live in an 80-year-old house where the roof is falling down and the floor is falling out. But I have a wife who loves me and children whom I love more than life itself. And for those reasons, I cannot sit here and say to you that the United States is an appropriate arbiter of which among the people of Libya we shall take away what little they have and render wailing widows into the streets. I will not do that. I cannot do that. Kate writes in, Bob, this won't be over for a while. Odyssey, any long journey filled with adventure and hardships. Dawn, the beginning. This is more about Kissinger and Negroponte and all those boys who need disruption and control, just saying. Kate continues, I'm working with homeless and or crippled vets here in Montana. Many of them who talk to me are tired of this, yes, even the young ones. It is truly heartbreaking to see the mess that we have made of our youngsters. A couple of trips through the outpatient clinic at the VA hospital should give sane folks a clue. Indeed. Kate mentions the young folks on Saturday at the rally in D.C. And I saw a young man. I would guess not even into his 30s. He was wearing some remainder of military BDUs. Around his neck he wore wrapped a keffiyeh, you know, the checkered scarf of the Arab world. Pinned to his chest was a purple heart and several campaign ribbons. He came from Louisiana. You could hear it in his voice. And he was confused. I don't mean he wasn't making sense. But he was confused and sorely wanting in understanding for why it was necessary or deemed necessary to send him in to the bloody meat grinder in the sand. As an aside, his last name was Choate. C-H-O-A-T-E. And when I heard his name, I thought, my God, it might be kinfolks. Because back in the 19th century, Viola Luzetta Choate of Round County, Kentucky, married Kentucky Joe Joseph Borders Davis, and they were the parents of my grandmother. A lot of people populated what was then called the West, out of the not so far West. And who knows but what some Choates, distant cousins, found their way to Louisiana. But you know what? When the boys who sound a lot more like me than they do other regions start questioning our little imperial adventures, you know there's trouble. When even the rednecks are beginning to wonder what we're up to, you know, the rednecks who don't generally much care what it is we're fighting about as long as they're a fight, and I want me some of that. You know, it's getting a little bit sideways. He it was who on Sunday at the Marine base at Quantico tore the medals from his chest and cast them to the ground. And I don't think that was done lightly. I'm quite certain it was not done lightly. For we have a Purple Heart here, awarded posthumously to my uncle, and we hold on to it, along with his letter signed by Franklin Roosevelt, his certificate, and his 48-starred flag, faded over the years. We hang on to it as memento mori. Just some reflections based upon an email. Darlene has written in, Bob, here's the problem I have with war. From Ann Jones, interviewed on Democracy Now! On September 30th, 2010, Ann Jones has spent much of the past 9 years in Afghanistan working as a journalist, photographer, and humanitarian aid worker. She has focused largely on the impact of the war, the impact the war has had on the women of Afghanistan. Her new book is War Is Not Over When It's Over, Women and the Unseen Consequences of Conflict. She writes, what I'm trying to suggest is that war is not what we think it is when we hear all these reports about soldiers and generals and strategies. War includes the whole population. War is fought on civilian ground, and in all modern wars, civilians are the primary casualties of war, much more so than soldiers, and we ignore that completely. Also, war is a guy thing. Men fight with each other. Then they sit down at the table, negotiate some kind of power-sharing agreement, and go on jockeying for that power relationship as they rule the country. But all the while they go on raping, murdering, displacing women and children, so that when men end war and say, now we have peace, war is not over for women. The war against women goes on to such an extent that today, if you look at the demographics, we are short 60 million women in this world who have been killed and lost in war. So Darlene closes by saying, Bob, when it comes right down to it, war is legalized genocide. When you kill the women and their children, you destroy the society, period. The U.S. can never do anything different, can it? It keeps stubbornly making the same damned mistake over and over again. Betsy writes, before I taught this afternoon, I went to my son's school with his allergy medication. Two high schools, 20 minutes apart. Two different branches of the service recruiting. At the predominantly white school were two white Army enlisted men with written materials, DVDs, and so forth. At the 90% minority school were two Navy enlisted men in a tricked-out pickup truck with propaganda on the sides and the roof.
Blech.
How is it that we can afford to pay for new wars, recruiters, and brand-new high school grads or dropouts, but we can't afford to educate the young people while they're still in school? Betsy. Well, the answer is... Betsy adds, the sailors at the 90% minority school were Hispanic. You send the white folks to the white school and the brown-skinned folks to the brown-skinned school. Jesus. It's marketing! In answer to Betsy's question, however, how can we pay for it? Well, you know, but we can't afford to educate the young people while they're still in school. Well, you don't want to educate them too much. Especially if they're in schools that have proven to be successful feeding grounds for the vultures of the military. The predators of the military. You don't want to, you don't want to be teaching Proust to 12th graders who 6 months later you hope to have marching around on in a square, marching up and down, turning left when they're told to turn left and turning right when they're told to turn right, and blindly obeying anything. You don't want them contemplating non-Euclidean geometric conundrums when the only purpose they are meant to serve is to go and kill someone, some other young person who is equally benighted to the broad fascination of the true human experience. You don't want that. I was explaining that to Ferg the other day. I asked him straight up, I said, son, why do you think they prefer to have 18-year-olds instead of 28-year-olds in the military? And he didn't have to think long. He said, well, because we've been talking about being impulsive and not engaging brain before engaging mouth. That had been the topic of the conversation. And flowing from that, I asked Ferg, you know, why do you think they want 18-year-olds instead of 28-year-olds in the military? And he said, well, probably, Dad, because 18-year-olds will not question when they are told to do stupid things as long as the person telling them to do the stupid thing has more authority than they have. And I thought, by God, every now and then I get something through. So we're working on that. By the way, this is sort of I'm serving as a translator for a reach out here. Just got a note from Cowgirl, Patty, up in North Dakota. She said, I just popped in as I got back from checking cow calves and heard you reading the email from Kate. I run into Montana a lot this time of year to do ranch biz and was thinking it might be fun to meet Kate if I happen to be near where she is. Heck, she may want to meet my peace and justice buds in Montana, too. If you would, please send her my email address, and if she wants to meet at some point in the near future, she can contact me, and we can see if it would work out. Nice. Very nice. I'm constantly humbled by what happens here. Because even though this is just a bunch of electrons banging heads together, going out into the God knows where, it has a habit of creating community. And that is a beautiful thing to behold. It truly is. Somehow or another, I've eaten up the first 50 minutes of the show talking about all of this. I really didn't mean to, because I actually had this thing all themed out. I tell you what we'll do. We'll take a little break. Yeah, you're right, Betsy. Not just community. Family. The Horn family. Indeed. Family. Just got a snippet of lyric from Burt Bacharach from Jim. The windows of the world are covered with rain. What is this world coming to? Everybody knows when men cannot be friends, their quarrel often ends when some have to die. Let the sun shine through. And I guess I'm a product of my upbringing and my time. Most among us are. And because I was exposed to things like science fiction at a relatively early age and lots of ancient history, the two sort of merged. And I wound up with this hopeful vision of a time when humanity would transcend its uglier, more violent side and reach out into the stars. Now I find myself hoping that we manage to scrape enough budget together somewhere along the way to keep looking out to the stars, because I am despairing of our ability to even much longer live on this planet, considering what we do to it. Dear Jesus, that mystery oil slick. Yeah, that mystery oil slick that just popped up in the Gulf, and everyone went, where in the hell did that come from? Well, we know now. You'll find out, too, in just a minute when you listen to the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. Hint. Round up the usual suspects. So that's the beginning of the program. By the way, thank you very, very kindly. We are five more thrifty 250 members to the good, thanks to a very generous contributor. It is much appreciated. So now we only need 69. 69 folks, $10 a piece. There are, and ever so much more, so many more, in this audience than that. Lots and lots more. I think we can end March's fundraising before March does. And when it does, I don't know. I may run naked in the yard, except for the fact that it's 36 degrees outside and spring apparently sprang and then thought better of it and left. Agnes showed me something earlier today. We've got this mostly dead old maple tree in the front yard up by the driveway. It was pruned more or less to death. But it is a happy place for one creature. Even though we were safe inside behind walls and everything, still this morning, Agnes shushed me. Shh. And up at the top of that pruned, nigh unto death tree, clinging to the side of the upmost part of the trunk, was a pileated woodpecker. Big old feller, or lady, with head just as red could be, working on home. Working. That means it was probably the female. And you see things like that and you just think you've been given a little gift from the universe. And you think that because you have. So up next, the Green News Report, Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And a little music in front of that, kindly provided by Sandra. I heard this earlier and I thought, oh yeah, oh yeah. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn. This goes out to the transnational corporate people and the warmongers.
Press a man, where you gonna run to? Down, press a man, where you gonna run to? Down, press a man, where you gonna run to? All along that day.
Down press a man. down press the man, down press the man, down press the man. Can't call him in a bar. He can drink some devil soup. Can't bribe him around the corner. Can't test him faith. Down press the man, Lord. Down press the man.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, March 24, 2011.
Tap water warning lifted for Tokyo babies, but spreading elsewhere.
Yes, these are significantly elevated levels of radiation in the food chain now and in the water, but are they at levels that are really going to harm people?
Nuclear workers at the stricken Japanese plant hospitalized for radiation exposure. Nukes now less popular in the U.S. for some reason. Plus,
looking back to a happier yesterday, a tourist brochure for Ofunatsu lying in the rubble here.
Maintaining tradition in Japanese towns amidst the rubble.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
What is that black smoke and what does it mean?
It either means the reactor has gone critical or they've elected a new pope.
Yeah, let's go with that one, Stephen. This is your Green News Report.
Which is good because it looks like the old one is melting down.
Okay, Des, I did a bit of figuring yesterday to sort of put the disaster in Japan into perspective. The latest estimates of the dead and missing there are now more than 25,000. Comparing Japan's population to the U.S. population, that would be more than 62,000 Americans killed in a single day had we had a similar disaster here. Furthermore, from Reuters, estimating the cost of damage from the earthquake and tsunami, it's believed that those costs will top $300 billion, making it the world's costliest natural disaster. And even more perspective for folks here in the U.S., Hurricane Katrina cost the U.S. just $81 billion in damage. That compared to $300 billion now in Japan's disaster.
We'll have more on Japan in a moment. But first, a Houston oil company has accepted responsibility for that mystery oil slick that was spotted in the Gulf of Mexico over the weekend. They originally told the Coast Guard it was only 5 gallons, but somehow...
5 gallons!
But somehow it turned into a 30-mile oil slick.
Yes, and they didn't admit anything until the Coast Guard caught them at the wellhead with a remote submarine trying to fix or shut down what was supposed to be a dead well.
Yep. The Arctic ice cap is shrinking. The National Snow and Ice Data Center announced Wednesday that sea ice cover at the top of the world reached a record low this year. Loss of sea ice cover impacts Arctic species like seals and polar bears, whose primary habitat is the ice. And scientists say the loss of ice is also important because it creates a feedback loop. White ice reflects the sun's rays, but darker water absorbs it, warming the water even more, which in turn melts even more ice.
So just to repeat, Arctic ice at a record low. GOP denials of global warming at a record high.
At the other end of the world, in Antarctica, researchers using underwater cameras have witnessed an invasion of king crabs coming farther south. Not a good sign, since the researchers say the large spiny crustaceans haven't been in the Antarctic for more than 40 million years, because the water used to be too cold for them.
Repeating again, GOP denial of global warming at a record high.
Nukes are losing popularity in the U.S. The nuclear crisis in Japan has had an impact on public opinion on nuclear power in the U.S. A new CBS poll shows Americans' approval of new nuclear power plants has dropped to below the level just after the Three Mile Island accident in 1979. The situation remains fluid at Japan's stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The battle to control and stabilize reactors at the plant was interrupted when workers were temporarily evacuated from reactor number 3 after 2 workers were hospitalized following radiation exposure. Officials say the men developed radiation burns after stepping into water that apparently turned out to be radioactive. New testing of the Tokyo water supply shows that levels of radiation that exceeded legal limits have dropped, and Tokyo's tap water is now safe for infants. A spike in radiation levels in Tokyo and 2 neighboring prefectures prompted the Japanese government earlier this week to warn residents to not give tap water to infants.
Except for infants, the radiation levels will have no effect on people.
Radiation is still elevated in neighboring prefectures.
In an interview I did on Pacifica Radio on Wednesday with Voice of America's Northeast Asian Bureau Chief Steve Herman, he explained that legal levels for radiation are much lower in Japan than they are for the rest of the world.
And most other countries, if they had this level of radioactive iodine in the water, then they wouldn't be announcing that it was above the standards.
Some comfort there, Des?
Well, I guess it depends on if you believe the government.
And what's not to believe from the Japanese or U.S. governments? Decide for yourself. Read up about that and much more at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider sponsoring us with a donation. We are listener-supported radio and rely on you to keep telling the truth on our public airwaves. We'll leave you today with a report from Alex Thompson of Britain's Channel 4 from Offanato, Japan, covering the attempt of towns to maintain tradition even amongst this disaster, where each town plays public music at 5 o'clock. The music played each day at Offanato is particularly poignant as the town struggles to pull itself back together. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Each Japanese town has its own tune. And this town's, as it happens, is yesterday.
Something sweet for the troops. Choose from a selection of Bubble Genius bath and body products, and we'll send them to soldiers overseas on your behalf. The holidays are coming up. Buy a soldier a shower.
BubbleGenius.com.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right.
We do?
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Ten minutes past the hour. Don't you love the oil slick story? Didn't that just make... Oh, Jesus. That's kind of why I played the Peter Tosh tune in front. Because, see, it's not about violence. It's not about hunting down anybody and taking them out. It's about the fact that there will be no place to hide because they've run out of planet. These consumptives. These locusts upon the field of humanity. These corporate predators. Yeah. 11 past the hour. Again, just a gentle reminder that over at headonradionetwork.com, under the tab Contribute, there's a PayPal button and a snail mail address. Either one will suffice nicely toward getting us done with fundraising for the month of March. I'm trying to be optimistic about all this. The fact of the matter is we're actually behind some. This is the last week of March, and therefore we should be trying to raise $625. However, we're actually trying to raise now $740, so we're behind by about $125, $120, $115. I can't do math on the fly, but anyway, it's reachable. So it's just a matter of 74 people and $10 a piece. That would be great. So there we are. Now, as far as I actually had I kind of had some things themed up for this evening. And we'll start with this. It was back in October when I featured this on the program, this sleazy, Sinophobic, fear-mongering, mendacious piece of crap from Citizens Against Government Waste, which is nothing but an astroturf gang of right-wing thugs. Yet, lo and behold, today I had, CNN on. I mean, really, it beats Days of Our Lives, but just barely. Or whatever the soap opera was. Because basketball didn't start until tonight. Go Arizona. Is it too late for me to say go Arizona? Well, nasty little Duke people. Now I'll get an email. Dear Bob, I was just about to send you $1 million. For the horn, but I went to Duke, and now I hate your guts. I'm sorry, I don't like Duke. no, it was back in October when Citizens Against Government Waste unveiled this ad, and now they have apparently sleazed and slimed and cajoled and conned enough money out of enough corporations and various and sundry teabaggers and the like to run it on national television. You might remember this. Beijing, China, 2030 AD. Scary Chinese man asks, why do great nations fall? The ancient Greeks, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, he's wearing his little Mao suit, and the United States of America. They all make the same mistakes, turning their back on the principles. This is a lecture hall that made them great. America tried to spend and tax itself out of a great recession. Enormous so-called stimulus spending, massive changes to health care, government takeovers of private industries, and crushing debt. Of course, we owned most of their debt, he says, laughing inscrutably. So now they work for us. And all the scary Chinese people laugh.
Have to join citizens against government waste to stop the spending that is bankrupting America.
To stop the spending that is bankrupting America. Yes, the Asian menace. It's running on CNN now. It was bad enough when it was online. Now the fact that it is being broadcast to a credulous American public that is already, by virtue of the very history of this nation, predisposed to xenophobia, racism, and hate. And, of course, it's fraudulent. It's fraudulent in its facts as well. Because the causes of the fall of the Greek Empire, of the Roman Empire, depending on which one you're talking about, whether it be the Roman Empire of the West in roughly 476 AD, or the Roman Empire of the East in May of 1453, otherwise known as the Byzantine Empire, had nothing to do with trying to spend one's way out of an economic slump. Absolutely nothing. In fact, it's clear from this ad that the folks at Citizens Against Government Waste never read any history of the empires of which they to which they refer. Because if you want to find out about the real causes of collapse, for instance, in the Byzantine Empire, you will find that eventually the Byzantine Empire developed a class, an aristocratic class, a patrician class, if you will, that was so rich and controlled so much of the property of the empire that the poor and what passed for a middle class in the 10th and 11th centuries of the common era couldn't survive. At the same time, they kept weak, semi-ineffectual emperors on the throne who they made sure continued to cut taxes for the wealthiest among them. And of course, the wealthiest among them were never a significant portion of the population. They just owned a significant portion of the economy. And they drove the Byzantine Empire to its knees by refusing to pay for its upkeep. So the question is, looking at an ad like this, so overtly racist, so overtly xenophobic and sinophobic, why in God's name would CNN have agreed to run it? Let's put it this way. If it had been an ad that replaced the Irish, replaced the Chinese with the Irish, or an ad that replaced the Chinese with the Italians, or here in our own country with black people or Hispanics, or atheists, or gay people, that thing could never have run. But because it warned against the yellow peril, and because the check cleared, and because CNN has no regard whatsoever for anything passingly resembling facts, it runs. And it spawns little racists and helps give succor and nurture to them. When the one thing this world most desperately needs is an end to the bigotry that plagues us. And so what we have, in essence, is an example of right-wing fraud. And like I said, I themed up the program this evening, and I've got several examples. Here's another. You recall, maybe a couple of weeks ago, when a deputy attorney general for the state of Indiana named Jeffrey Cox tweeted that police in Wisconsin should use live ammunition against the protesters there. Well, Indiana has another problem on its hands. And I don't know what the, I don't know what it is about Indiana. Maybe some Indianans can explain it to me. We have American citizens who happen to reside in Indiana within our listening audience. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism has released an email from a deputy prosecutor in Indiana. What is it with these authoritarian right-wing lawyers in Indiana? It suggests to Wisconsin Governor Snot Walker what he should do to break the back of the protest movement in Indiana. Carlos F. Lam, L-A-M, is the author, the signed author of the email. He is an official, he's not only a deputy prosecutor in Johnson County, Indiana, he is also a public official, a GOP public official. He's a Republican. And he wrote in this email to Snot Walker, as an aside, I've been involved in GOP politics here in Indiana for 18 years, and I think that the situation in Wisconsin presents a good opportunity for what's called a false flag operation. If you could employ an associate who pretends to be sympathetic to the union's cause to physically attack you, or even use a firearm against you, you could discredit the public unions. Currently, the media is painting. You see, Carlos F. Lam is a linguistic jackass, too. It's not the media is, it's the media are, Carlos, you goddamn moron. Currently, the media is painting the union protest as a democratic uprising and failing to mention the role of the DNC and umbrella union organizations. Shit. I didn't even know there was an umbrella union. Umbrella union organizations in the protest. Employing a false flag operation would assist in undercutting any support that the media may be creating in favor of the unions. Now, this is the same Carlos F. Lam who has said that Indiana is an unsustainable public worker gravy train bubble, and has also said unions and companies that feed at the government trough will fight tooth and nail against anything that unfeathers their nests. My goodness gracious, he must be just a real effing joy at around the punch bowl at the Christmas party, don't you think? Haw, haw, haw. Now, wait a minute. I got another joke. I got a joke about one of them. It's a real knee slapper. I know, wrong accent. So here's the fun part. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism contacted Carlos F. Lamb. And they asked him if the Hotmail address that the email had come from belongs to him. And he said, well, it does. But I categorically deny sending that email. I am flabbergasted and would never advocate for something like this and would like everyone to be sure that that's just not me. I will file a police report about the matter this week, and then OJ and I will go out and find the real emailer. Okay, I added the OJ part. It's his email. What? Yeah, it's his Hotmail address, but I don't know. You know, that maybe that was kitten typing. You know how it is. You've got the little cat back there with you. We got a cat here, and she sometimes comes in and cat types for me. It seldom comes out quite as sleazy or insidious or filthy as what Carlos F. Lamb's cat typed, but oh, wait, it wasn't Carlos F. Lamb's cat. The Johnson County, Indiana Prosecutor's Office has now stated that Carlos F. Lamb has admitted that he wrote the email and has resigned his post. If he has not already said it, he will say in a matter of days, "Those damned liberals cost me my job!" Yeah, you're right, Marty. It is an O'Keefe tactic. It's straight out of O'Keefe's book. This is what not taking down two-legged turds like James O'Keefe gets you. By the way, before he admitted having sent it, he went into his boss, the Johnson County prosecutor, elected official. Boss, I never said that. I don't know who that. Somebody, is probably a false flag operation from from those liberal umbrella union workers. Because Johnson, the prosecutor of Johnson County, Indiana, whose name I do not have at present, told the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism he didn't send it. That's right before, I guess, they confirmed the IP address and all of that inconvenient stuff that happens to go along with one's email. At which point Carlos F. Lamb sorta, kinda had to confess that, yes, he suggested that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, a man oath-bound, use dummied-up attackers in order to discredit a movement that is based upon nothing more than the hopes of people, ordinary working people, that they will not be destroyed so that the Koch brothers can have some more tax cuts. Yes, the Johnson County, Indiana Prosecutor's Office has a problem this evening.
I'm leaving.
Do you get back here, you pious, silly side waiter? There's no way that nobody's gonna leave this town. Hell, I was born here, and I was raised here, and dadgummit, I'm gonna die here. And no sidewinding, bushwhacking, hornswoggling, crocker crocker is gonna roll my Christmas color.
Now, who can argue with that?
Robert!
I think we're all indebted to Gabby Johnson for clearly stating what needed to be said. I'm particularly glad that these lovely children are here today to hear that speech. Not only was it authentic frontier gibberish, it expressed a courage little seen in this day and age. What are we made of? Our fathers came across the prairie, fought Indians, fought drought, fought locusts, fought Dix. Remember when Richard Dix came in here and tried to take over the town? But we didn't give up then. And by gum, we're not gonna give up now.
Rabbit.
Olson Johnson is right. What kind of people are we anyhow? I say we stay and fight it up.
Dr. Samuel Johnson's right about Olson Johnson's being right. And I'm not giving up my ice cream parlor that I built with these two hands for nothing or nobody.
Howard Johnson is right.
Thank you, man.
Reverend!
Well, if we're on
a... problem in Johnson County. You gotta laugh a little bit. Come on. Can you imagine this? This right-wing repig-licking freak wrote to the sitting governor of Wisconsin, if you could employ an associate who pretends to be sympathetic to the union's cause to physically attack you or even use a firearm against you, .. Really? Snot Walker would pre-soak himself at the sight of someone pointing a goddamned water pistol at him. Attack you with a weapon? If you could pay someone to physically attack you, you know, you just get the idea that Carlos F. Lamb probably, Saturday night, goes to somebody that, come on, whip me, beat me, call me Edna, make me write bad checks. You know, he's that kind of repig-licking. This would be a perfect opportunity for a false flag attack. And by the way, the email, according to Think Progress, the email that Carlos F. Lamb sent went out the very same day that the email went out from Deputy Indiana Attorney General Jeffrey Cox, sent out his tweet about live ammunition. And you think that these people aren't putting they're not coming up with these ideas independently. Repiglickens aren't that bright. This is all worked out in advance. That's why it started in Wisconsin and Ohio, and it's happening in Maine and New Jersey and Michigan. There have been substantial union presences in each of those states. And what they're trying to do is up the odds If they can't get one, they'll get another. And if they can break one, they can break all. Marty, Bob, don't be such a conspiracy theorist. Let me do it. And, no, I get it. You know, you can just see, you know, sometime after Carlos F. Lamb, former assistant prosecutor for Johnson County, Indiana, gets done getting his spanking or whatever, crying on her shoulder and saying, "They didn't just take my job, but the liberal media, they took away my First Amendment rights. Because it's politically correct, and I wasn't politically correct, and I just told the truth about what that patriotic, heroic-looking Governor Walker needs to do to get rid of these communist Bolshevik unions." Come on. Tell me. You can't hear that. He was an assistant prosecutor. Tell me, Carlos F. Lamb probably didn't like a little spanking now and then. Yeah. Yeah, sort of kind of calls another clip to mind, if I may. Yeah, this one.
What am I talking about? I can't hear you.
Jesus.
I still can't hear you.
Jesus
Christ our Lord. Do you know his name?
Have
you seen his glory? Have you felt the warming comfort of his precious love? Praise Jesus. Praise his holy name. Praise his blessed spirit. Praise his everlasting love. Jesus Christ our Lord. Listen to me now. Listen to me. The prince of darkness is upon the lion. Now in the Bible, his name is Beelzebub, Lord of the flies. Right now on earth today, his name is Bolshevik, socialist, communist, union man, Lord of untruth, sower of evil seed, enemy of all that is good and pure, and this creature walks among us.
You know, they still talk like that. They still talk like that when Repiglickens get together. Oddly enough, when they've been getting together lately, it's been a lot smaller Clavering meeting, though. I don't know if you saw this last weekend. The Teabaggers had a big old teabagging convention scheduled for Tampa, Florida. Oh, the luminaries were all going to come out. Representative Ron Paul, whose image adorned a phony piece of currency for which people were recently convicted. Representative Ron Paul and Fox News Judge Andrew Napolitano and former GOP Congressman Tom Tancredo. That's a Lakota Sioux word, because Tom Tancredo, he's an American and he don't like no immigrants. Oh, they were all going to be there. There was going to be 25 guest speakers at this big old teabagging convention in Tampa. 25 guest speakers. Tickets were only $99 a piece. Entertainment was going to be headlined by Jordan Page, whomever the hell he is. Oh, it was good. They were going to... They had him a real schmick little website, and they had him quotes from George Washington. The time is near at hand which must determine whether Americans are to be free men or slaves. They had them some quotes from Ben Franklin on their little website and some quotes from Thomas Jefferson. What a teabag and a high time it was going to be. Joseph Farah, the founder of World Nut Daily, was going to speak at the event, and he said there's going to be lots of opportunities for interactivity between participants and presenters, and he did not lie! For 3 days, the ratio of attendee to speaker was about one for every 7.5 attendees. That's some up close and they drew about 300 people. About 300 teabaggers in a great big ballroom. Teabaggers in a ballroom, that sounds a little obscene, doesn't it? Yeah. That's what they had. And they had that even with a sponsorship from the John Birch Society and an appearance by Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers Militia. There's only one photo of a very, 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 very empty ballroom. Because while these are people for a constitutional government, their constitutional government they want to have doesn't allow video recorders and audio rendering devices because they were prohibited and would be grounds for removal without refund. Can't quite stand the light of day, I guess. Wonder if Carlos F. Lam went down to that teabagging festival. For that matter, I'd love to know where Carlos F. Lam got his lawyer and diploma. Wonder if it came from the same diploma factory that bright light of fundamentalist lawyer and that screwed up the Department of Justice for a generation under the George W. Bush administration. Monica Goodling. Reckon she was a graduate of the Pat Robertson School of Law or the Patrick Henry School of Law or the Draw Spunky on the Back of the Matchbook School of Law. You kind of got to figure. Because it really does take that kind of reasoning to come up with an idea that would get Snot Walker bounced out on his double right cheek butt. False flag operation. Jesus. So it's about 18 minutes before the hour. Let's take a little musical interlude. What the hell? A little something live from the patron saint band of the Horn. From later with Jules Holland, the Drive-By Truckers. Drag the lake, Charlie. Because God knows that's what they did when they, in order to find the likes of Charles Lamb.
Drag the
Then again, when they found Charles Lamb, as was noted in the chat room, it wasn't from dragging a lake; it was from dragging a septic tank. But look, why are we? Well, you're not. I'm not surprised that the first place that Repiglicans go is the notion that in order to succeed, they have to lie, cheat, steal, backstab, and double dirty deal. The reason they go there is because, well, that's how they are. It's the only way they have, the only way they know for winning. And believe me, they want to win at all costs. Any cost. So we have that. But that is not all. You remember last night we talked a little bit about, what's his name? The teabagger in Maine, Governor LePage. Well, his rationale for taking down murals in the Department of Labor in Maine is that they have had complaints. Do you hear the S? Complaints. That it creates it makes business people uncomfortable to see all of those see remembrances of all of those workers standing on their hind legs. Interestingly, when pressed for it, Governor LePage, who proudly admits that when he was a child he would throw rocks at French Canadians. I guess you got to be proud of something. He said, "Well, here it is. This is why we're doing it. See, I got this here fax. And he hand and they pass out this thing. Governor addressed to the Honorable Paul R. LePage. Dear Governor LePage, welcome to Augusta. You are doing a great job. Keep it up. The purpose of my letter is to express by disbelief. You know, even when they're dummying up stuff, they still can't spell. The purpose of my letter is to express by disbelief of what I saw at the Maine Department of Labor offices in Augusta during a recent visit. While sitting in the lobby, I had the opportunity to study a very large mural which adorns the lobby area. In this mural, I observed a figure which closely resembles the former Commissioner of Labor. In studying the mural, I observed that this mural is nothing but propaganda to further the agenda of the union movement. I felt for a moment that I was in communist North Korea, where they use these murals to brainwash the masses. Mr. LePage, with all due respect, I must say, Mr. LePage, please tear down this mural. Isn't that sweet? He's kind of playing with the words of St. Ronnie of Raygun, which is appropriate, seeing as how we're busy killing Libyan people right now, and St. Ronnie of Raygun was a leader in that by killing a 3-year-old baby. Again, thank you for your candor and fresh approach to state government. Keep up the good work. No signature. And remember, they said it was a fax. But here's the fun part. If you ever gotten a fax, you know that there's a banner at the top of the fax that gives the phone number it comes from, the name of the organization, yada, 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 and the date and time of transmission. None of that was apparent. It wasn't, not, stop with the gobbledygook language, Bob. It wasn't not apparent, it wasn't there! And it wasn't there because it didn't exist. It wasn't there because this is a dummied up, faked up, frauded up, ginned up, rubed up piece of crap. That mural is nothing but propaganda. I felt for a minute that I was in communist North Korea. Really? I've seen pictures of the murals and there's no Korean script on it. And everybody isn't walking around in boring gray clothing. And, oddly enough, everybody in the murals is not Korean! Yeah, no transmission time, no transmission date. And it's, purports to be from a secret admirer. Well, if you're a secret admirer, why does it have to be a secret? I mean, is this another one of those repiglic and hypocritical, you know, log cabin things? Well, Governor LePage is now scrambling. LePage's spokesperson was apparently even a little bit embarrassed by it all and told TPM that the LePage administration was not trying to give validity to the sentiments in the facts. There has thus far not been a single whit, not an iota, of public opposition to the existence of the murals. What we're dealing with here is basically the American Taliban. Do you remember those magnificent statues of the Buddha that had been carved into hollowed-out rock spaces in the cliff sides of Bamiyan in Afghanistan, that had stood at the intersection of a major trade route through Central Asia for centuries upon centuries, perhaps millennia? They were doing no one any harm. They were just art. But when you are insistent upon ideological purity, even something as innocuous and silent as a statue or a painting cannot be tolerated. And so it is, so it was, that the Taliban in Afghanistan put dynamite charges under the Buddha because their own god was too weak to tolerate the presence of a piece of carven rock. And so it is with the American Taliban and Governor Paul LePage, that his ideology is so craven and so weak as to be unable to tolerate the presence, the mere presence, in a public building of a representation of working people standing up for themselves in a building that houses a department dedicated to the well-being of working people.
people. This is how fascism behaves. This is how empire behaves. You know, God, I didn't mean for it to be Empire Week on the Horn. It just kind of turned out that way, didn't it? Mr. LePage, tear down this mural. And by the way, with this story creating no small amount of controversy, the LePage administration in Maine is having to back into a bit of a corner. Everything from local newspapers in Maine all the way to the New York Times reported that the complaint, you know, the tear down this mural thing that I read you, that it was a fax. All these news organizations described it as fax because the governor's office had described it as a fax. But now LePage says, well, that's not a fax. That's a letter. See, it's a letter. That's why there's no fax banner on it, because it's a letter. Wait. Let me find the quote again. Here it is. Carlos F. Lamb. I am flabbergasted and would never advocate for something like this and would like everyone to be sure that that's just not me. Except for the fact that it came from my IP address on my email account and, well, yeah, it is me. Liars. Liars. Nothing but a gang of repulsive, repellent liars. And just as the Taliban in Afghanistan, in fact, did blow up the Bamiyan Buddhas, I would give you 8-2 odds that the LePage administration will tear down those murals. Because they don't give a tinker's damn for what anyone thinks. They have an agenda to advance, and they will advance it at all costs. And they will do anything to get their way. Fraud is in the way of how Repiglicans operate. And it puts us at a distinct disadvantage, because where on our side we like to use things like facts, and we like to argue from the standpoint of what is factually correct and what is, fluid word, I admit, true. Truth is meaningless. Utterly and absolutely meaningless to a bunch of no-goods whose only goal is the acquisition and further enhancement of power. Jack writes in from Shreveport, Bob, I heard you say the judge, I think I said governor, in Maine said that he wanted to take the murals down because business people would be uncomfortable seeing images of laborers. The corporatists that would come to that building deal with beating down labor every day. Those corporatists could hardly be swayed by murals.
any small business people would probably identify more with the laborers in the artwork. True in all instances. What I said was that the alleged complaint was that the murals made it uncomfortable for people from the business community. There was a quote from the spokesperson who said it was pure gibberish about making our public buildings friendly to all of our constituencies, the business constituency, because business is now a constituency of government. Maybe I shouldn't say now. Business is a constituency of government, which is antithetical, of course, to any concept of democracy. But no, the corporatists aren't nearly as concerned about having to look at the little people. The corporatists are more concerned that little people might look at the murals and be reminded that there were people among them who had not always been sheep bleating on the way either to their shearing or their slaughter. David in Tennessee noting, please remember, the Taliban literally cut the noses off young women to discourage their desire to learn to read. They cut off noses, we bust unions and take down murals. Indeed. They also advocate that false flag attacks in which someone physically attack the governor so that attacks may be unleashed on those self-same union workers. And that email goes out on the same day that another person in the same state, another lawyer, advocates that when violence happens, that live ammunition be used on the protesters. Noses, spleens, kidneys, brains on the pavement. Thugs is thugs is thugs. Jim, I don't know. I saw yesterday who did the murals. No, it wasn't Diego Rivera. They don't go that far back. They're not like those magnificent murals, for instance, in the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. It's just a little bit of artwork to make a little less sterile, otherwise sterile government buildings. It was paid for with a federal grant in the not-too-distant past. I think they cost $400,000 or something. And that may be as much a part of it as anything. We don't want people having any idea that an appropriate usage of public funds is the advancement of the arts. Because, you know, that art stuff, that's sissy stuff. And if working people have time for art, well, by God, that means they must not be working as much as they should. You know, things just haven't been the same for the American business corporate community since that 80-hour work week went away. That's probably when America began to turn from God. Shavis. Yeah. So, but that's not all. That's not all. So we'll take a little break and come back to your phone calls. Lines are open. You know the number, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304. 658-3333. Still looking for numbers 74, 73. No, we're down to 69. Numbers 69, 68, etc. Downward toward clearing out the fundraising goal for this month. $10 a piece, 69 people. It's not that, well, one would hope not that difficult. Though I do know, as well as anyone, how tight money is. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. Somehow or another, this just seems appropriate this evening. We'll be right back. I'm Bob. This is The Horn.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep it doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. First you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
Yeah, at least a little more detail on the artists with the murals in Maine. They were executed by a native Mainer, a woman renowned for her work. She has given life to the art community in Maine, and in turn that has given hope to any number of people who aspire to a similar career. She has sort of put a little bit of air in the sails of the idea that there are incomes available to Mainers who don't necessarily wish to go to welding or fishing school. Not that there's anything wrong with welding or fishing, but that there is an artistic, it is possible to have an artistic life. So her high water mark is to be stricken from the public consciousness by virtue of one godforsaken, made-up, phony, dummied-up, ginned-up, utterly unreal facts or epistle of utterly mystical origin. And therein, you have conservatism at its finest. I think there's actually a fancy-ass word for destroying art in support of some larger policy-driven goal. Isn't that called iconoclasm? By God, I do believe it is. Lines are open. 12 minutes past the hour of 8 o'clock, about 35 or so minutes left of conversation in the program if you want to jump in. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey there, how you doing?
What's up, Jim?
Well, the reason I sent you the email about Diego Rivera is because, and I saw this in the film, Frida Kahlo, who was his paramour, and Rivera.
Magnificent film, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Remember when Diego Rivera was invited to New York to do the mural?
Mm-hmm.
For the Rockefellers, and in one of the murals, or one of the principal panels, there was a image of Lenin, and the Standard Oil people had him remove that immediately. It was a big stink about that.
Right, because, you know, conservatives don't get art, do they?
Well, no, because, of course, guess who Diego Rivera befriended when he was in exile in Mexico?
Sure.
Leon Trotsky.
So right. Whose granddaughter is, I believe, a brain surgeon.
Who, Trotsky's?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I remember hearing some NPR feature piece on that a couple of years back. She's a neurologist or a brain surgeon or something like that, yeah.
I thought he died without issue, but no, because I thought that all of his children, like Lev and the others, ended up in canals in Paris and stuff like that at the behest of Stalin, but I'm glad one of them got through, I guess.
Apparently one did.
Yeah. Yeah, but they made Diego, I think he left. There was a big controversy about that because the mural was considered to be, you know, dangerous to whomever thought it was dangerous. So, I mean, there's precedence of this. And, of course, the destruction of art that is, well, not exactly in line with the state. I mean, look at some of the shit arts the Nazis had in their galleries.
Right, right. And I guess he was this anonymous and probably entirely fictional complainer is talking about that sort of heroic communist art that was promulgated out of the Soviet Union. But frankly, the Nazis did the same thing. You know, the muscle-bound. Well, you know what I'm talking about.
I do, yeah. I've seen all those Nazi art shows and stuff like that.
And it has a lot more to do, I think, with a sort of modernism, a sort of failed modernism, than it does with political ideology.
Yeah. I mean, the Stalin had socialist realism, which was boring, too, really. It was, to me.
It goes nicely with square concrete buildings, though.
Well, I guess so. I mean, God. Look at some of the architecture, that wedding cake stuff that he supported. But I mean, it's just incredible.
You know, the heroic Nazi stuff with the knights in shining armor. I mean,
yeah, well, that's what the Fuhrer and Goebbels and who was his minister, Russ or somebody like that was his name. They were all, wanted to glorify the Aryan Superman with all these heroic statues of animals and Teutonic supermen and stuff like that. I don't know.
David in Tennessee asking, he says, didn't Uncle Adolf want to destroy all the art outside of his personal tastes? There was some quote about, if the artist should make the sky green and the grass blue, they must be stopped.
Yeah. Hitler had some strange ideas about art and architecture. For example, he didn't like buildings with a flat roof because he considered those to be Bolshevistic. Only a pitched roof could survive under his regime.
You know, where does that come from, Jim? I mean, that's just, a flat roof is Bolshevik.
That's what Hitler did. Well, I mean, you know,
I mean, that's just crazy, you know? I mean, that's authentic frontier gibberish.
But, you know, in contrast, strangely enough, have you ever seen pictures of his Reich Chancellery?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's incredibly beautiful stuff. I mean, by contrast, I mean, they could be so stupid, and then they could produce some things that were just incredibly beautiful. But by another look at it, for example, he had planned all these buildings to Berlin, you know, that one with the big dome on it and all this kinds of stuff, that big triumphal arch. Well, guess what? Berlin's a sandy place, and Berlin would never have supported all those buildings he wanted to build. But he still insisted that they, construction go on with them anyway, you know. It's just incredible, and look what Stalin did. He blew up one of the churches and was going to build one of these big palaces to the Soviets, and thank God that monstrosity never got built, because they had never torn that son of a bitch down.
But, you know, history is full of those short-sighted people. I forget who the emperor was, when Constantine won the Battle of the Milvian Bridge.
Yeah.
You know, with all that in hoc signo wing case, the hooey.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that was emperor in Rome at the time had engaged in an absolutely ruinous program of building. Rome was taxed to its absolute limits.
Was it Maximius or Maximus?
Yeah, I think it was Maximius. I think you're right, Jim. I think you're right.
Yeah,
and he wound up drowning in the Tiber, trying to get away from the Milvian Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But he had become loathed because he was dumping the entire good of the state into a monstrous act of ego. He was building the Basilica Maximius, among other things.
Yeah.
And it turned the people against him because, you know, the city was starving. And when I say taxed, I don't mean like, you know, he subjected them to taxation. He just ruined the federal treasury, the empire treasury, imperial treasury, in his building programs. And nothing could deter him from building his monuments to his own ego.
Well, the same thing happened to Nero's Golden House. Remember that?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the Domusaria.
Yeah, but he only enjoyed that for about 4 months before... he got a knife, or somebody put, or he committed suicide, or I'm not sure how he went. I think he stuck a knife in his throat or something, some crap.
Yeah, I seem to remember knife and neck in the same sentence.
It's just amazing what, you know, how these people will construct these things and try to impose their taste in art and architecture upon other people, you know.
And so now, instead of that, we have a sort of similar thing in these right wingers who insist on building fiscal monuments to themselves in the form of these, you know, these giveaways to the corporate transnationals. I mean, for God's sakes, this story is a couple of days old, but one of the things that the Republicans in the House want to do, the House Agriculture Committee. Has called for a reduction in food stamps rather than reduce agricultural subsidies. all this budget, budgetary mumbo-jumbo and this hateful cost-cutting austerity crap that the Republicans have embraced as some do a fraudulent hunk of the true cross. Well, instead of cutting stuff that actually matters, you know, the stuff, I mean, everybody knows. I mean, these are facts, Jim, that are, I mean, they're facts. They are undeniably, inseparably connected to reality. The food stamp program does more economic good than just about any other program in the government because it stimulates retail sales.
Well, they don't care about that. They want to spend money on other things. And they always end up spending us into absolute oblivion. I mean, they're the most fiscally irresponsible people to claim that banner of fiscal responsibility that I've ever known.
But, you know, the government's already cut food stamps once to pay for a jobs bill, and there's another cut coming to pay for the Healthy Schools lunch program, you know, to put more broccoli on the plates. In other words, really, and the Obama administration was terribly, terribly, and Michelle, the First Lady, was terribly, terribly proud of that. They raided the food stamp program to pay for allegedly better food in school lunches. Now, if that's not the ultimate example of robbing Peter to pay Paul, I don't know what the hell is.
Well, you're right. I mean, I can't understand why you can't have good school lunches and a well-funded food stamp program that does put money into the economy and not to mention food into people's bellies.
Well, there is that, yes.
And that's just crazy. But they claim to be the party of fiscal responsibility.
Right.
Yet they end up sending us right into the poorhouse on what they consider to be their prerogatives. And that's what they consider it to be. They don't. It's a prerogative with these people. I mean, it's their, you know, their so-called given right.
I don't know if they're prerogatives so much as they are sinecures and satrapies. This is mind-boggling because while declaring that food stamps must be cut, they have declared off-limits and untouchable and sacrosanct agriculture subsidies, 90% of the money for which goes to large farming corporations, you know, like...
agribusiness.
Monster agribusiness, and goes primarily to the production of corn, wheat, rice, soy, and cotton. You know, I saw cotton in that list, and I was reminded of that chapter from Catch-22 where Milo Minderbinder tries to get Yossarian to eat some chocolate-covered cotton because he's bought too much in Egypt.
Yeah. Well, I guess they consider these commodities to be more, exportable and money-making for...
Well, for instance, where corn is concerned, this country is caught up in a giant dodge called ethanol.
Yeah.
And so more corn is grown in this country for ethanol than is grown for food.
That's right.
And then the corn that is grown for so-called food is not really food because it's used for the production of... It's number two field-grade corn, and it's used for the production of high-fructose corn syrup and maltodextrin and, that other poisonous crap. A very... Just the tiniest, tiniest percentage of corn in this that is grown in this country actually winds up on someone's dinner table as corn. A can of Green Giant Niblets. It fosters famine, among other things. People who are fans of, people who are fans of tequila. I was reading this over at Bart Cop one day, Jim. Are a little concerned because Mexican farmers, the agave azul, which is whence real tequila comes,
yeah,
is a very fragile and delicate plant.
Takes years to build for that thing.
Takes 8 years to grow a mashable, what they call pineapple, to make tequila. It takes 8 years. And Mexican farmers are plowing that under so that they can plant number two field grade corn for ethanol as well. Meanwhile, those filthy hybridized Monsanto seeds blow on the wind and run the risk of driving in the entirety of Meso and Central America into famine by corrupting the very cradle of maize production, because maize developed in extreme southern Mexico and the Guatemalan highlands thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. And if those maize strains are corrupted by Roundup Ready corn, starvation can very well, very easily set in.
Yeah, this business of bioengineering or biotech engineering is very dangerous when they start messing with stuff like that. They don't seem to care.
No, because they're getting, among other things, paid not to care.
Well, there you go. There's always a payoff in it for somebody on the upper end of the financial spectrum, isn't there?
Yeah. Again, as David in Tennessee notes, that's robbing a thousand Peters to pay one Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And as David notes, to pay one Paul, their Paul. It's like a little bit like food stamps. It's a little bit like W.C. Fields saying, "I always believe in giving to the poor. Poor me."
Yeah, exactly. Well, it leads me back when Nancy Reagan said that ketchup was a vegetable.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was some real compassion there. Boy, did they have to suck on that one, didn't they?
Didn't seem to slow them down much, though, did it?
Nah, not really. But, I mean, it sure embarrassed
them. Ketchup is a vegetable, and, I don't know, mustard's an energy drink.
There you go. I mean, these people have no sense of...
But karma comes around. You know, the same people that said ketchup is a vegetable, the same guy that said ketchup is a vegetable wound up one. No, that was mean, wasn't it?
You talking about Jim Brady?
No, I'm talking about Ronald Reagan.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, he did. Yeah, he certainly did. I mean, karma is hard to overcome. I mean, I don't know. But these people simply have no sense of, in my opinion, I would just call it no sense of decency. No sense of decency whatsoever. Whether they're dealing with foodstuffs or directing money into wrong channels and defunding programs that should help people, that could help people, and they don't care what it costs or who it hurts, or it makes me personally feel extremely bitter, and
I don't begrudge you that feeling one iota, Jim, because if you didn't feel bitter, I would think there was probably something badly wrong, because, you know, I was going to say, when you reached back to ketchup as a vegetable, it is astonishing, or at least it is to me, when sometimes I look back and I think about the stuff that has just sort of been put out into the social atmosphere in the relatively short time that I've been on the planet. Because no matter how old any of us get to be, it's still a relatively short time on the planet.
These people will use food as a weapon. Or the lack of food as a weapon, you know? That's exactly what they're doing.
God, I didn't even get that far. You get the toaster tonight, Jim. Yes, the Republican Party and these so-called conservatives are more than happy to use food as a weapon.
Sure. I mean, remember those Omen movies?
Oh, yeah.
Remember how they were going to do all this stuff? I think it was Omen 2 or something like that, where they were going to use starvation to use that as a means of getting their way to establish their order or whatever. And the foreign corporation, I think it was portrayed in the movie. I can't see much difference between that and what these people are doing that you were talking about earlier. Maybe I'm being overly simplistic here. I don't think I missed the point, though. But it's using food as a weapon. And, you know, if somebody will use food as a weapon, they'll do anything. I mean, there's nothing they won't do to achieve their own selfish ends. And it makes me very bitter and very hostile. And, you know, and it makes me very uncaring as to whether or not they survive or not. I mean, I could care less if these people were to disappear from the planet overnight for what good they're doing.
Yeah.
For all the evil they're doing. But I was just reminded of that, and I guess we started off on Diego Rivera and the mural and how they took that down, wanted to control art. And God, they want to control art. They want to control architecture, as they did in history. And then now they're going into other areas of society, like food production, and directing it in the wrong way. And
well, as usual, they are what they most frequently criticize. You know, the right wing likes to complain that the so-called left, the imaginary left, for all intents and purposes in this country, Jim, is deep into social engineering. I mean, and wealth redistribution.
Of course.
But this is the bunch that's engineering the society, isn't it?
It would appear so. Yes, it does.
Because they're engineering a culture and a society that they would make not in their own image, but in the image they most desire. And that is an image of desperate working people, too terrified to stand up to them so that they may just go on being the locusts that they are. This is not the locust and the ant. This is the demise of the ants and the triumph of the locusts.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think eventually their sins will find them out, because they're more hungry people, more poor people than there are wealthy people. And how long could they continue to destroy their own support base that keeps them in mink and trashy novels, you know?
You know what, that's almost a song title if somebody wants to work on it. Mink and trashy novels.
Well, that's exactly what these people are into, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know, if any of them had an original thought in their head, the damn thing would die of loneliness. I'm just going all over the board tonight.
Well, but Jim, thanks for the provision of a giggle or two as we wander down the corridor to the abattoir.
There you go. But you know, maybe one day they're going to be in that abattoir. Hey, the sun does not shine on one dog's ass all the time, Bob.
Or one cat's, as I hear her in the background.
Yeah, that's a shady lady. She said to tell you hello.
All right, I will. I will pass her regards on to the Princess Mushu in the other side of the mansion.
Sounds good to me.
All right, take care, Jim.
Good night.
Bye now. Speaking of food stamps, that's our buddy Jim, by the way. Can't let this one go. This provision buried way deep inside a bill introduced in the House of Representatives by a gang of right-wing repig-licking thugs is frankly stunning. The gang of thugs includes GOP Representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio, Tim Scott of course, South Carolina, Scott Garrett of New Jersey, Dan Burton of Indiana. Remember Dan Burton? Dan Burton was during the Clinton years, Dan Burton was to watermelons what Dirty Harry was to bad guys. Dan Burton is the just batshit crazy guy who went out in his backyard to shoot watermelons in order to prove that Hillary killed Vince Foster.
Jesus, I wish I was making that up. But no, including Dan Burton of Indiana and, of course, Louis Terror Babies Gohmert. They've introduced H.R. 1135. Oh, what a piece of work this is. How bored... No, it's not boredom. It's just plain old-fashioned, shitty, mean-spiritedness. That's what this is. H.R. 1135. Designed, quote, to provide information on total spending on means-tested welfare programs, to provide additional work requirements, and to provide an overall spending limit on means-tested welfare programs. An overall spending limit. Because, remember, it was the so-called welfare reform that Bill Clinton thought was such a nifty-ass idea in, what, 1995? That made sure that there are only 5 years of aid to families with dependent children, you know, otherwise known as getting a check. Only 5 years of that, and after that, it's F you. Well, this is an expansion. An overall spending limit on means-tested welfare programs. And means-testing, of course, you have to be poor to a certain level in order to get food stamps. And so that means it's means-tested. An overall spending limit, meaning you can only collect so much in food stamps in your life. After that, you just get to effing starve. Starve! Thank you, John Hagee. As Think Progress notes, most of the bill is based on verifying that those who receive food stamp benefits are meeting the federal requirements for doing so. But as has also been noted elsewhere, way, 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 way deep down in one of the creepy, spidery, dark little corners of the bill is a little something-something, a little love tap for anybody who decides to get uppity with their betters, I mean bosses, I mean employers. I find it astonishing that this is being introduced in or around the same time as the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. But Repiglickens don't give a damn. Here's the language from the bill. Section 3. Striking workers ineligible. Notwithstanding any other provision of law, no member of a family unit shall participate in the food stamp program at any time that any able-bodied work eligible adult member of such household is on strike as defined in the Labor Management Relations Act, 1947, 29 U.S.C. 142, paren 2, close paren, because of a labor dispute other than a lockout as defined in Section 2, Paragraph 9 of the National Labor Relations Act. You got that? If your employer is treating you like human waste and persists in refusing to pay you a living wage, a wage commensurate with the labor which you provide to said employer, and if you, in conjunction with your other fellow servants, that's the kind of language the law uses, fellow servants, decide to band together in exercise of your First Amendment rights, which don't really exist because the First Amendment is no longer anything more than a life support system for the religion industry. If you do that, and if you strike, and if the strike drags on, and you become ineligible, or you become unable, I should say, to feed your family, or as George W. Bush famously said, put food on your family, then Representatives Jordan, Scott, Garrett, Burton, and Gohmert want to make sure that you understand that you will, and more importantly, your loved ones, your babes in arms, will starve. You got that, citizen? Don't be thinking you're gonna get up on your hind legs and act like a human being and stand nose to nose and eye to eye with your betters! Because as Jim noted, the Repiglican Party wants you to understand that they are more than willing to use food as a weapon. And all the little knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, elbow- and knee-pad-wearing, oatmeal-dribbling, house-helmet-wearing teabaggers say, thank God we're a-taking our country back. Just makes you feel all warm and fuzzy inside and maybe want to cue up a little bit of Lee Greenwood. Be thanking God that we're Americans, where at least we know we're free. It is 2011. It is the day before, it is March the 24th, the day before the anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, in which 146 people died, 123 of them young women and little girls, who died because their bosses locked them into their workplaces because they were afraid that the women would steal scraps of cloth and bits of lace and go home and try to make clothing that would make them look a little less destitute, or perhaps make extra money on the side. The Triangle Building was famously, as you may recall, well, much as the Titanic, a year or so later, was billed as being unsinkable, the Triangle Building was billed as being unburnable. And it was. But all the cotton and the dust and the thread and the people were more than combustible. Young immigrant women leapt down elevator shafts and out of windows. And yet, just as a half a century later, murderers in Mississippi would be given a free pass by all white male juries there for murders of economically oppressed, racially oppressed people, so too in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, it took less than a matter of a couple of hours for that all-male, all-white jury to return a verdict of exoneration for the bosses who had paid the women pennies, who offered bribes
to the living witnesses to change their stories. September 11th, 2001 was not the first time that New Yorkers watched the horror of human beings leaping to their deaths from a burning building. They saw it. They saw it on March the 25th, 1911 as well. But somehow or another, we are willing to flog the bloody shirt of September 11th, 2001 in our grasping, stumbling path toward empire. But most of America has forgotten those baby steps taken through blood for basic human dignity. The Jewish community in New York City rose up and became intensely involved in issues of social justice, in large part because of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. It was a commitment to social justice that would carry through over a half a century and become a bulwark of the struggle for civil rights in the states of the old Confederacy. And now, 100 years after the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, we have two-legged, unmitigated, utter and absolute monsters who so fear, who so dread the idea of working people having dignity that they are willing to threaten the very lives of those workers' children in order to make sure that they do not dare to exercise the rights that are guaranteed to them under the Constitution. Dear God, where is this country going? The question is not rhetorical. Where is this country going? The report I'm looking at says, it appears that the right is simply looking for more ways to hurt working class Americans. No, no, no. The right is looking for ways to destroy working class Americans. Because remember, whatever it is that those strikers are working for, there's someone else that will work for less. And there is no law, or virtually no law, in this country against hiring those things which are the lowest form of life that lives upon the planet. Scabs. Scabs. thinking about striking, member of a union? If this thing passes, you'll think twice. But I ask you an important question. And this is not self-aggrandizement. I hope you know me well enough by now to know that. How many places, reaching how many people, will this story be told in? Will Cutesy Couric feature it? Brian Williams? You can forget about Radio Rwanda. Will Morning Joe find time for this story? I think you know that the answer is no, 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 and no. Don't look for it between the reports on some local car wreck and some celebrity, God knows what, atrocity on CNN. Don't look for it on headline news. Oh, I have no doubt that Ed Schultz will run with this story. I've no doubt that Rachel Maddow will run with this story. Maybe Jon Stewart can turn it into something funny on his program. Or maybe Stephen Colbert. But it won't be a big deal in Jim Jordan's district in Ohio. There won't be protest rallies outside Tim Scott's local offices in South Carolina. In New Jersey, Scott Garrett will feel no wrath from his electorate for it. Dan Burton in Indiana, well, nobody wants to get near his office. He might mistake you for a watermelon and blow your ass away. And Louis Gohmert in Texas? Hell, they just don't care. You'll probably hear about it on Malloy. You'll probably hear about it on Rick Smith. Maybe Hartman will mention it. But everybody listening to those programs already knows what a bunch of murderous thugs the right wing are. Oh, God. And Louis Gohmert and Scott Garrett and Dan Burton and Tim Scott and Jim Jordan. Why, they're all pro-life. Unless the life's daddy happens to be on strike. Unless the life would like to keep eating. And then, well then, they're just Bolsheviks. Union men. And they walk among us. So that's the program for this evening. And we are almost out of the 60s now, looking for a close to March's fundraising. This program will reach far more people than that in the next 24 hours. We're down to 63. If it's worthwhile that there be one more outlet that puts out information, useful, usable information like this, then 63 people with $10 makes it happen for another month. Because that's how we operate around here. Month to month. We are not perpetually endowed like the various and sundry filth spigots of the right wing. It only happens because you make it happen. So thanks to everybody who makes it happen, from you who contribute both your money
and your precious time. To Lottie in the chat room, to John Fox in Australia, slaving away over a hot computer, keeping the website going, keeping, well, the audio behaving as best the audio may, to Ben Birch in Illinois, from whose servers stream forth everything you hear on the horn, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, and a very special congratulations to Gene. Newly married Gene. Newly married news ninja, Gene. Gene and Anne were joined in nuptial bliss on the 19th of March. And all of our heartiest and happiest congratulations go out to them for a long and happy time together. Thanks go out to our blogger, Texas Betsy, our op-ed columnist, Reverbo, Cavalcade of Crazy, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne, OsborneInc.com, OsborneInc.com, needs your help. He's trying to get a scholarship to Netroots Nation. Netroots Nation won't be the same without Matt Osborne there documenting it. He needs your help. Just go to OsborneInc.com and follow the links and go and vote for him at Democracy for America. You'll not be spammed over it or anything like that. Just give Matt Osborne your vote, please. I'm staying out of the competition. I won it 1 year. I'm trying to make room for others. Give Matt Osborne any vote that you would give me, and tell your friends and neighbors, please, to go and vote for Matt Osborne. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net and coalriverwind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next.